more complicated. Back to you, Dave.
Okay, N2ACG, I appreciate everybody's comments and stuff, and I understand what Howie's trying to say. You know, like I said, this is not my system. I have no, you know, direct affiliation with it. I'm just a ham looking at it, what they have and saying, hey, this is, you know, we could fix this right quick and we could do it in a week or two without any major expense. Making the antenna shouldn't be a problem. You know, the rudimentary supplies are there. I'm sure I can make a, you know, 4, 5, 6 element Yagi for them. With their assistance, they're actually going to make it. I'm just going to kind of steer them in the right direction. And the feed line is going to be replaced. You know, we put a new feed line up with the, you know, with the new Yagi. As far as the distance up and down the beach, the back side of the beam has to be able to communicate maybe a half a mile, 3/4 mile at the most. The front side of the beam, we're talking 7-8 miles. And, you know, they're not having any trouble with the portable units that are fairly close in, but the communication with the distant handy-talkies is a little spotty. As far as height goes, I don't think they're going to be able to get it up much higher than about 20, 25 feet because of the you know, just the situation, the building and, you know, what they have. So they're probably going to wind up sticking the new antenna. I don't want to even tell you what they have the old antenna on. You ready for this? The old, the vertical Ringo Ranger that they have up is literally clamped onto some PVC tubing pipe that they jury-rigged up on the roof. So that's, you know, that's what you're dealing with. You know, some of these municipalities, you can request something. You know, we need this, we need that, we need that. 2 years down the road, you get a no answer. We can't spend the money. So, you know, I'm looking at fixing it within a week or two, helping them, you know, get a better communication system for the summer. Back to you, Dick.
Oh, by the way, what kind of base station do they have?
As far as what, radio?
Yeah, what are they using at the base? What kind of radio is it?
It looks like I think it's a Kenwood commercial mobile unit.
Yeah, you really want to, see, I don't know how old it is, you really want to take a look at the sensitivity. You really want to make sure, because you might put up the antenna. I've done a lot of this stuff where you put together a system. Andy will tell you that you really got to check out the individual components. They've been on the beach, corrosion gets into the walkie-talkies, but you also want to make sure the base station is working correctly. You know, you want to put a bird watch meter, check out the output. You really just don't want to run to an antenna. Check out each individual component and make sure that the individual components of the system are working to specs. You know, the base should do about 1/4 to 1/2 a mic of a... You never know. I've seen where the, you know, where the board gets cruddy and the transistor gets disconnected from the board. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, it's an extremely good suggestion. The getting back from the handy talkie, which is only running 5 watts, back to the base station could really be difficult because of antenna gain low. That Ringo Ranger is meant to be mounted on a metal pipe. It's mounted on PVC. Subtracts from its performance. The Ringo Ranger doesn't have ground plane radials. It depends on the metal pipe it's supposed to be mounted on. The coax cable is possibly marginal. The transceiver in the base station, does it have 1/4 microvolt of sensitivity? If it's up to some ridiculous number of microvolts, then a handy talkie that's more than 1/4 mile away is going to be hard to hear, so to speak. So somebody walking up to that base station someday with a service monitor and knows how to use it and does a fairly quick check of each handy talkie's sensitivity and the base station radio receiver sensitivity, and the service monitor will also tell you how many watts, it or a bird watt meter will tell you how many watts is coming out of the transmitter, and so a number of checks should be done. But that Ringo Ranger should not have been mounted on PVC. The instructions don't make that clear. And you've heard the story so many times before on the Ringo Ranger antennas, either the 2-meter version or the 450 version. Some hams love them, some hams hate them. It's the exact same antenna. Well, some guys mount it on a metal pipe of the right length. Some people mount it on a metal pipe or a PVC pipe, you could say, of the wrong length, and therefore the pattern gets disturbed because the antenna depends on the metal that you mount it to be the phony ground plane radials that have never been put there in the first place. The Yagi antenna, if you do choose to go with the Yagi antenna, homebrew or a modified commercial product, the good news, it'll give you some nice signal strength up the beach in the 7-mile direction. And Yagi designs try very hard to have a high front-to-back ratio. In your case, mile or two in the other direction, you want a Yagi that has a fairly poor front-to-back ratio. Well, that's easy. To kill the gain in the reverse direction by disturbing the reflector, that's easy. Everybody fights real hard to try to kill the gain in the reverse direction. You want a little bit of gain in the reverse direction. All you got to do is not retune the reflector or intentionally detune the reflector. It'll have an extremely small effect on forward gain. One of the real eye openings that I did with my 19-element Yagi, I'm very carefully tuning it, is that when I got it all working real well, I removed the reflector entirely because the whole back hemisphere wasn't being redirected forward in my mind. I thought I would lose 3 dB of gain. It was hard for me to measure the amount of gain that I lost when I took the reflector off the antenna entirely. The biggest thing I could tell is the standing wave ratio of the driven element changed, and it had to be retuned. So I think I lost something like a half a dB or 3/10 of a dB, something damn small, when I removed the reflector entirely. So for you to intentionally deflect the antenna so that it has a little bit of gain in the back direction and 90-some-odd% of the gain in the forward direction, that's a nice way to go. And as long as you're sure you're only going to be transmitting up and down the beach and not over the causeway, so to speak, in other directions, then the Yagi is a nice approach. You don't need omnidirectional. So you've got lots of ways to go here, Dave, and without too much effort, I think you can make a lot of progress in that system. And what's sad in what you're describing is that this is a life-threatening situation. There are times when that radio link will help you save lives. And for people to not realize that and not to ensure that they've got very good, well-engineered and well-operating equipment when it is a potential life-saving piece of hardware, that sure is sad. And 2APG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2APG, the picture actually gets worse. The antenna is literally mounted a few feet away from power lines that supply power to the building. And I pointed that out to him. I said, you see what you got here? I said, God forbid that antenna comes down or something like that and gets wrapped around the power lines and somebody gets zapped when they pick up that microphone. You got a big problem here. I said, this is a horrendous setup. But, I was amazed, too, when I saw it. I said, you got to be kidding me. Who put this up? It certainly wasn't done professionally. It looks like they just, somebody threw the antenna up, like I said, on this pole. So it's hopefully, the new Yagi with new feed line mounted in a slightly different location away from the power line. I'm thinking we'll give them some improvement. And, that's where it's at. So, all right, appreciate all the advice. I'll let you carry on. N2APG.
WBKWW, I'd like to amplify something that Dick just said.
Great, Harry.
Yeah, I would not monkey around with making antennas. I would read a riot act to these people. I'll tell you why. It may sound like they're doing a good deed by trying to cut, save them money. But if it's on a beach where someone's life could be at hand, and if you give them something, it can come back to haunt you in liability. If you have a commercial, I have a commercial ticket, and my attitude would be to tell them, look, this is life safety. You need to do it right. Over to you, Dick.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I would recommend taking a picture and just writing a couple of words saying, you have got to be kidding, and send it into the town, and maybe they'll get a professional group out there to change everything for them. Back to you, Dick.
Exactly what I said, liability.
Yeah, you do have to be careful here, Dave. I think there is a so-called Good Samaritan clause that's been added to some of our laws lately, where there was a situation on a couple of occasions where a physician saw an automobile accident and could have helped, but because of the restrictions that were given to him by his insurance policy holder, that he wasn't supposed to be involved in something that wasn't directly brought to him under normal circumstances because of the potential liability risk. And so I think they've created a little bit of a workaround in this one, and I hope they have. You better check on that before you go too far downrange, because as you help them, if there's the slightest hiccup in the system, in theory, you could be sued. When it comes to the antenna being mounted near the power lines, the first thing an amateur radio operator usually worries about is that, hey, the signal won't go through the power lines. Don't worry about that one, particularly with a vertically polarized signal. I think it's vertically polarized. So the power lines are reasonably transparent as far as the RF is concerned. That's the good news. But if they're any closer than, let me pick a number, 6 feet from the power lines, and it's a 6 foot high antenna, that's not good. And yes, touching the power lines is certainly bad. So even though it's inconvenient, somebody's got to mount it further away or move the power line. I know there's bucks involved in all of this. And even if you have to put the antenna a little bit lower, but getting it away from the power line, you're certainly right on that one. So lots of things to worry about here, Dave. Go a little bit slow. I know you want to help, but do check on the particulars of their liability policy. They might not even have one. Does the organization you work for give you any kind of protection? That's something to consider. However, the protection that your organization you work for may only give you protection when you're on an official job of your organization. And when you're doing something auxiliary like this for an adjacent organization, are you still covered? Do you have a homeowner policy that covers you? Is there a rider on that one? So, go a little bit slow. Don't move too fast on this one, Dave. N2APG, KQRIW.
Understood. Understood completely. Like I said, you know, when I explained it and stuff, it sounds like I'm going to go up on the roof and do all this stuff. I'm not going anywhere near the roof. They're going to do it all, if they do it. And the idea with the picture and all that stuff is really a good thing. Because, yeah, maybe, perhaps, if I can steer them in that direction, that they could go to somebody higher up from them and say, hey, you know, this, we got a problem down here. This is all, you know, it's not working right, and we need somebody to come in here and fix it. That would be the best thing, to get a professional outfit to come in and do it right and do it, you know, above board and stuff like that. But from what they're telling me, it, you know, the reality is it just won't happen.
Yeah. When I say go slow, I'm talking about anything to do with the antenna and the roof. When it comes to just simply borrowing somebody's service monitor, finding out how to use it, and walking it into their base station, and during an off hour, whatever the heck that means, maybe at high noon, it's not as needed as it is at midnight, or vice versa, making a quick measurement of power output and of the transmitter and microvolts of sensitivity, and if the handy talkies are sitting there into their chargers because they're not being used at that particular period of time, and you can pick up the handy talkies one at a time and measure their sensitivity. There, I think there's no liability risk. You're just trying to find out where they stand. And while the service monitor or bird watt meter is there, it sure would be nice to look at the standing wave ratio of their antenna. A certain percentage of the time, cable that's in bad shape will show up as standing wave ratio. But that's not a guarantee, as you know. A very lossy piece of cable could be a beautiful 50-ohm dummy load and not deliver very much antenna signal to the antenna, and yet not give you very much VISWAR. So the high VISWAR of the antenna would be a strong indication of a lot of services needed right away. A low VISWAR of the antenna means that you pass the first test, it's ready for the next test, and then the next test would be a field strength measurement when the transmitter is on, and you go 1,000 feet downrange, what signal strength is that is coming out of the antenna. I know this is getting a little bit elaborate, but at least these are some diagnostic measurements you can make before you change anything, just to find out where do they stand. If you have reason to believe by way of a field strength measurement that the transmitter of 30 watts is putting 20 watts out of the antenna, that's an extremely good sign. And you can see where we're going here. So before you get involved just doing diagnostics, I'd like to believe there's no liability risk there. But once you make the slightest modification to the system, I think you're crossing the threshold of worrying about now who picks up the tab if there is a liability. Has anyone got any suggestions on what I just said to either improve or counter what I just said? Please give me a call at us right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2HWW, Dick.
Yeah. Go ahead, Howie.
And what the truth is, because life is involved, there are people swimming, and that's it. You say, oh, don't worry about it. You really got to just tell them the truth about how well the system is working. That would be my recommendation. So that way you're clean and everybody knows where they stand, because you're dealing with life and safety. They can't communicate if someone drowns. Oh, boy.
Yep, I agree with you. So I think you haven't crossed the threshold when you do diagnostics to tell how good or bad their system is. but when you start making suggestions, I think you should change this antenna and go to that. I think you've crossed the threshold where they could come back and get you in the worst case scenario. I wonder if you see it the same way, Dave.
This is K2KE1.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. That, like I said, my input is just as a casual observer at this point. There's no official involvement. They would be doing it, as far as official any changes. They're doing the changes, that kind of. It's all being done by the head honcho that runs that operation. I just made a suggestion to him, seeing what they had. My suggestion was, if you put a Yagi up, I think you'd have a much better communication with the distant units that that right now are a little spotty. So like I said, any modifications, any changes, whatever, they are actually going to do it. I'm just kind of, giving them some ideas and that kind of thing.
Understand. Mel, go ahead.
This is K2KEY. I did a repair job for a similar situation, a place that is run for the... these are children, handicapped children, and mentally disturbed young people. And they didn't have much in the way of money. It's run by a charity and all. And I told them the situation and all, and they said, well, they're going to have to pass the hat around if anything major had to be done. And I says, well, the only thing is I brought up the same situation. I says, I'm just telling you, I don't want to have any kind of a worse situation developing here with a liability. Oh, no, we're not. In fact, they had a form that anybody that volunteers with them to help them with repairs on the cabin, electrical, plumbing, which they had volunteers coming all the time. Some of them were parents or relatives or friends of parents of people that had these children with these problems. And whoever did any of the volunteer work gets a certificate of thank you, and that's it. There's no liability of any sort. It's just a thank you, and I never heard of any feedback on it. Depends on the situation, but like I say, I would never have hesitated once I knew it was, it was for a good cause takeover.
Sounds good. I've heard of something called the Good Samaritan Law.
At 8 o'clock.
Okay, it's 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, real. The Good Samaritan Law, which I think allows a physician arriving at an accident scene, even though he wasn't called, to help without creating a liability. I think there is such a thing, Good Samaritan Law. Does anybody know if there is such a thing? And is it only true only for physicians, or can anybody at a life-threatening situation help without getting themselves in trouble because of the so-called Good Samaritan Law? Who knows anything about that one?
KB10QD.
Go right ahead, Bob. I hope you know something about it.
Well, I'm involved with the local fire department here, and there is a Good Samaritan Act there. It goes as your knowledge.
We didn't hear what you said, Bob. I think there was a dropout. Either traveled into a bad area or the propagation changed. So you said that you work for a fire department or you're a member of a volunteer fire department, and that's as much as we heard. I wonder if you want to try again. KB1OQD, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Now, there is a Good Samaritan Act, and it's just going as far as, not going over the line as far as something like that. KB1OQD.
Okay. There is a Good Samaritan Law, and we heard everything on that last transmission. But who is protected by it? A physician, a volunteer fireman, an ordinary civilian trying to help? The Good Samaritan Law, is it statewide or is it federal? I mean, in Greenwich, Connecticut, you've got one. Do I have one on Long Island in New York State? So is it federal? Is it local? And who is it protecting? Only professionals? Or how about just an ordinary citizen? Who do you think it protects? Back to you, Bob.
No, it does protect a citizen. I don't know if it's federal or not, or just, you know, go statewide there, or countywide there, but I believe it's throughout the United States there. There is some, you know, kind of Good Samaritan Act there. You know, I basically, sometimes there's been situations people would have been at accident scenes and did nothing and drove away there, and I believe have gotten actually in trouble for not actually lending assistance there.
KB2HHU. KB2HHU. Start off with your name, sir, and tell us what you know about the subject. My name is Dick.
Yes, the name is Sigmund, Sierra India Echo, Golf Mike Uniform, November Delta. Sigmund, Sig for short. I'm over in Baldwin. How copy?
Very good copy, Sig. Go right ahead.
Good Samaritan law in New York State really covers lay people, people who are really not in the medical profession. That's the way I learned it as an EMT. Basically, what you're covered with is, you know, you're covered to the level of the scope of whatever you're trained for. So, say, if you know CPR or you know how to do the Heimlich maneuver or something along those lines, you're covered to that because you had some training in it and, you know, you did your effort for that. Physicians, EMTs, and so on are covered by New York State public health law. And, again, it's a different angle to it, but, again, it's generally the same jazz. Whatever you're trained for, whatever level you're at, the scope of your training, that's basically what you can do. If you go above and beyond that, you're in trouble. That's really the gist of it.
Okay, but now, Rich recognized, I'll get back to you in a second, Rich. Sig, here's the real problem. Let's say, for instance, I've had no formal training in CPR. I'm a lay citizen, not trained in medicine at all, and I'm at an accident scene, no one else is around, and I try to help. Because I have had no formal training, what in New York State, sounds to me like it is a statewide law, not a federal law, what do you believe I'm allowed to do before I cross the line and become liable? Back to you, Sig.
That's where the gray area comes. If you have no training in CPR, or you had, say, maybe you saw something about how CPR was performed, you could probably do it. And, you know, this is where the gray area is. If you do it incorrectly, what happens? That's a big if. You know, when you get into some egregious examples of things, for example, you know, common sense first aid, I think, you know, if somebody's bleeding, you know how to stop bleeding. You just try to stop it with a cloth or something like that. That's kind of common sense thing. You know, but if you're going to do some medical procedure that really only, say, a physician would know or something of those lines, and you think, you know, I saw this on, you know, if you try to attempt something like that that really is way beyond the scope of what a lay person would know, then you're getting into trouble. It is a gray area. It's not really a black and white thing. The big word is really the scope and level of training. It's a hard one, hard to answer.
So I see. So not quite as clear as we'd like it to be. Scope and level of training. Good buzzwords. And a person who has a completely blocked airway, and you as a untrained person try to do a rudimentary tracheotomy. Boy, you're pushing your luck on that one as I see it. N2EO, go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick. I personally would not get involved with it. You know, when the lawyers get involved, they look to sue everybody. And even though the head honcho is doing the work, he's making the suggestions, I wouldn't get involved with it.
Yeah, this is a little bit sad. I mean, some of the people within the sound of our voices tonight are going to eventually run into a situation where they're the first on scene and could help. And of course, there's conflict here as to how much help you can give without creating a problem. And there's multiple levels of what I'm saying when I say creating a problem. Truly, you know, a good physician is supposed to do no harm, or a good lay citizen should do no harm. So there's that level of a problem, as well as could you be sued later on because you did what you thought was good common sense, and it turned out not to be because of a lack of training. I don't know. I guess we should get on to more pleasant subjects. This is a tough one. Hey, Barry, what's the latest on your antenna endeavor? Have you made any progress? Ensign Moonbounce, are you still available? KQLIW.
Hey, Dick, WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
You know, did you hear what the other fellow said before? You could get sued if you don't do anything. So that means you're damned if you do it and you're damned if you don't. So my guess is save the person and let the clouds fall as they may. What the heck?
That's what I think each one of us would do. I'm going to turn it over to Barry, and if Barry doesn't have anything to add, Paul, we're going to find out what's going on in space. Barry, are you there?
Yeah, sure I am. Actually, I have done nothing further with my 75-meter beam, because 75 meters isn't so good lately. Summer came, and the band got bad. But I did do something strange. I put a high-resolution and infrared camera on my tower, just below my 2-meter beam. And I'm having a lot of fun with that. I could see for miles and miles and miles, and I don't even have to climb my tower. It's a lot of fun.
Remember, you and I, remember I said you've got some money in your pocket. When you run into another one of those, buy it, I'll reimburse you, and I'll even pay you a finder's fee and a shipping fee. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, I got a few. I don't know. I have some that are really hot and some that aren't so hot. I know what you want. I would have to check it out. They are infrared. They are good resolution. But when they switch to color, I got them really cheap, like $14 a piece, right? When they switch to color, the color's not so good. I don't know how important that is to you.
Not super important. I already own one of these camera housings that you've seen made for outdoor service. And so I've got a tower that could go on. I've got antennas that can aim to azimuth. I don't have an elevation control on it yet, although I'd like to add that. And so color would be nice. Good infrared would be nice. You tell me, and I'm going to go for it. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, what I'll do is I'll send you some snapshots off of my monitor of what I'm getting on different cameras and let you make the decision, Dick.
Okay, sounds good. The price is right. Okay, Paul, I know that this one story I heard would probably get garbled a little bit, and that is they turned on the new solar array on the International Space Station, and so therefore a much higher voltage was being applied to the power supplies and regulators in the computers, and that they created a fault in the computer, and that apparently this is a repeat scenario that once before, when a new solar panel was applied, the extra voltage gave the computer some real grief. Went beyond the not-to-exceed voltage on the voltage regulators of the computers. So I wonder if that's what happened in the last few days. I think there's a bit of an extension going on as to how long the space shuttle stays with the International Space Station during all of this installation, repair, and checkout, and so on. WS2N, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N. It looks like they've extended the mission. They plan on doing that anyway. Looks like because of the thermal blanket that was not set right. And if you've seen demonstrations of this thermal blanket, you know, it's kind of rigid. You know, it'll stay wherever you put it. You know, it looks like it's about an inch thick. And if you bend the corner up on it, it'll stay there. If you bend the corner back, it'll stay there. So they did plan on fixing that back in the by the Ohm's engine, the orbital maneuvering engines. They had this little triangular piece of it that moved after launch, and that is now repaired. They were able to bend that back into a position, and then they used some kind of surgical stapler gun to reattach it to the adjacent areas, so that will stay in proper location during reentry. Not to worry though, they had 700. They have 700 degrees roughly on that area during reentry, as opposed to the 3,000 degrees that you get on the carbon nose and tip tips of the wings of the orbiter during re-entry. Your earlier missions, you might remember many, many tiles used to fall off on the back, you know, a dozen or so sometimes, on the back of the shuttle near the shroud of that covers the orbital maneuvering engine. So they used to use tiles in most of those areas. They've done away with that. They use the thermal blankets now in that area. Good enough, you know, and that's what they use. So probably nothing would have happened, but they don't want an open area where you can create maybe a blowtorch type of an effect. And, they had the ability to do it, so they fixed it. The computer problem is another reason for them to keep that mission going for an extra couple of days. They needed the space shuttle up there to keep the attitude of the International Space Station properly oriented. The computer problems, when those Russian computers are down, I heard three of them, they control not only the oxygen and the water supply to the people and to the equipment, they control the attitude of the International Space Station by firing thrusters and getting information from the gyros that generally keep it in proper attitude. They need to keep the solar rays angled at the sun the best they can at all times to develop their electricity for the space station. With these computers down, that's a serious problem. They use the gyros on board that they located in the what they call the Z1 structure, right above the node that they have. The node is the connecting point. There's six different connecting points on that node. Node one, eventually there'll be a node two. One of the connection points are like the Destiny Lab. The one behind it is the Zarya functioning cargo block of the Russian module. And they have a situation with keeping the space station at the right attitude. Computers take information off the gyros. If the gyros get saturated and the station wants to keep moving, they fire thrusters, and that air thrusters on board the space station to keep it going, keep it in the right attitude. If that's not good enough, they usually use the backup Progress cargo ship or even the Soyuz spacecraft that's attached that brings up the crews every couple of months. So what they were using was the space shuttle. The space shuttle was there, and the space shuttle could fire its thrusters to keep its attitude there correct. Without the space shuttle there, not good enough. They would have had to abandon ship if these computers wanted to come back online. Less I heard is they did. My guess, it sounds like a few things I've read or heard on the news, mostly CNN, was that it seems to be this power supply problem. It sounds like they jumped it or bypassed it. These power supplies are probably switching power supplies, that's my guess, on all these computers. I'm happier with the heavier, older power supplies. I think they should stick with them. These switching power supplies, they're good, but I don't know. I think they seems like they have problems. They have, like you said, they have problems in the past. Hook up these solar panels, and one thing they haven't reported is that they hooked up those panels backwards at the beginning. The wiring of it was hooked up wrong. Now, I don't know if the astronauts did it or if it was improperly wired when they sensitive to space, because it, which is probably the case, because they knew one was wrong, and they made a switch, and then they knew they had to make the other side of the panel, they had to switch that. Maybe that caused it, I don't know. They did say they isolated it all from the Russian equipment. They still will have problems with the Russian equipment, but that doesn't say what initially did it. I think maybe they got a spike or something from the from this and wiped out their power supplies. Haven't heard this 100% yet. It'll come out later. You know, like when I do this NetDeck, I consider myself more or less a space historian, not current events. So, you know, these things are very changeable right now. Very dynamic situations going up on all these space missions from time to time. I just don't have it really 100% clear. I don't know if they do. I'm sure they don't. We'll have to see, Dick. But last I heard, everything's up and running, and I have a couple of other reports dealing with the Mars rovers, and if you want to talk about that for a minute. But everything looks like it's going okay. They do have the S3 and 4, S meaning starboard, 3 and 4 truss sections attached. Apparently, they've taken them out of a lot of these blocking pieces of equipment that they use to keep the this thing in place when they launch it. You got to take all of this stuff apart. They've done that to make it operable. This is similar to the P3 and P4 section that they did on an earlier mission. The idea, of course, is to have these gigantic solar panels be able to rotate, face the sun most of the time. I think it comes out like 75% of the time. You're always getting sun with the International Space Station, and they want to keep these panels always directly looking at the sun. So they rotate every hour and a half. I know we talked about it on the net. People have never heard this. Every hour and a half, the space station goes around the Earth. Every hour and a half, these solar panels will rotate. Well, it's operating on the fourth side now. When they're done, this will be operating on the starboard side. There's one set of panels yet to bring up, and that'll be located also on the starboard side. And then you say, well, what about the port side? There's only one set up there now. You know, where's the other one coming from? That's coming from the one that was sent up originally. That's mounted coming out of the Z1 truss and then into what they call the P6 truss section. That was the original panel that's up there, put up there about 5-6 years ago. That will eventually be disconnected and relocated to the port side. So you'll have two gigantic pairs of panels on the port side, and you'll eventually have two pairs on the starboard side once they bring this other set of panels up on a couple of missions from now. And then at that time, the whole space station will be completely energized. And that's the latest on the International Space Station. There's a lot more, of course, but back to you, Dick. WS.
Rather good report on the International Space Station and the Space Shuttle. When I pass it back to you, Paul, I'd like to know what's your best guess as to when the Space Shuttle will come back home, and tell us a little bit about what's going on at Mars. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, it's supposed to land, I believe, Thursday. That was my last report that I read. I think it was Thursday. And, of course, scheduled to land at the in Florida at the Space Center. And there's alternative landing sites all over, of course, at White Sands, New Mexico, which they've done a couple of times. Mostly, their alternative landing spot is California. And then there's, of course, emergency landing sites all over the globe, France, Spain, Morocco, all over everywhere. Even Easter Island is a possible emergency landing location. They're just all over. But I scheduled, I believe, Thursday. As far as Mars rovers are concerned, they're still operating after all these years, eventually going into a fourth year. Actually, they're into their fourth year. Back in December, they uploaded all kinds of software to make these things smarter. They can now tell the difference when they're looking at a set of rocks, which ones that they want to look at, which ones they should go around. The rovers can make decisions now by themselves. Makes things a lot quicker. Certain different modes that the thing is operating in, they can say, well, we're going to go off this direction and go that direction. This can now look at a series of rocks and say, hey, this one is this big and this one is that big. I know that, you know, I'm getting closer to it. They'll take a series of pictures and without communicating back to Earth, and they'll know that this thing is coming closer and it's a certain size and I want to go in that direction. They've actually made these things smarter over time because, hey, that was, what, 3-4 years ago. They developed better systems now, so they could actually change the original plans on the rovers from what they originally had by just changing the software. And they're actually using it as a testing bed because in 2009, I think they plan on launching the Mars laboratory up to Mars, which will be another one of these rovers. And of course, much more advanced. It'll be no solar panels, just be running off of plutonium and recharging batteries that way with these nuclear generators on board. The new rovers will have all of this modern software that they've developed and completely tested, actually, on a field in the Mars terrain on both rovers. So I thought that was pretty good. I wanted to mention Opportunity has now a problem with its right front wheel. We've talked about Spirit for years here on the net with its right front wheel that eventually showed a high amperage. You know, they sent telemetry back as well as pictures all the time of how these rovers are operating, and it shows running a higher amperage. They know that wheel is giving them problems. You might remember that with Spirit, and what they did was they ran the Spirit backwards for years now, and in certain locations they run it backwards. They just drag the right front wheel along, and they really work around these problems. And it's credit to Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California that handles all of this. Similar problem developed now with Opportunity with its right front wheel. What happens is the temperatures are way down. I mean, 100 degrees below zero or something like that at nighttime, and the swing of temperatures are like, 100 degrees one way or the other from day to day. So it causes problems, of course, with the oil that gets fed to these wheels. They have like little oil capillary systems, and they push the oil maybe through the to the wheels. It's not working out, anymore for these right front wheels. And these wide swings of temperatures, they've lost some sensors on board the rovers because eventually the solder joints and whatever starts to react with these gigantic temperature swings. You wind up little disconnects here and there, but they're still running, Dick, and it's still sending back valuable information, especially for future missions, next Mars mission is actually, I think, this August. They're going to launch Phoenix to the North Pole of Mars. Not a rover, but going to look for ice under the, or maybe even water, probably ice underneath the surface of Mars in the northern hemisphere there. So we'll look forward to that launch in August. Back to you, Dick, WS to land.
I have another quick question there, Paul. You said the Spirit and Opportunity going into their fourth year. That's fourth birth year. That's probably because there's a 2-to-1 ratio in the year for Mars versus Earth. I think it's the second Mars year. Are they now going into the Martian winter where they're located, Paul? Go ahead.
Just coming out of the Martian winter. I mean, they want to slope there for a couple of months, and they leave it there and basically, panel, like on a hill, they'll try to face it as best they can to the south and pick up the sun as best they can. But no, they're out of that, and I guess they're probably into spring now.
That's good. Okay. Glad all that hardware is working. And so we're looking forward to the space shuttle coming back on Thursday. Mel, I'll bet you've received a couple of emails this week. I think you guys who are writing to Mel got to go a little bit easy on him. I heard a report that last week you guys sending emails to Mel sent him 83 emails. That's a little bit excessive. So try to go easy on the poor guy. I think you're burying him in, I could say you're burying him in paper. You're burying him in email and the electronic equivalent. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
For sure, this is K2KEY. I think I got a total this week about 96. I think so, that's what it is. There are ones that I get people that are associated with companies would like me to get involved with certain products, and what do you think of this one, and what do you think of that one. This week was a number of people asking questions about rigs, and, they sorted stuff. You were mentioning, the camera outside, and too bad a couple of years ago you never said nothing to me, because when I was with the company, we dumped so much of that equipment. I have outside the camera up on my small tower, which has got the pan and the tilt, and it's got a zoom lens on it, and it's a lot of fun. I leave it facing actually onto the street. I have the controller in the with the joystick type of controller. And I have it facing down the street. So it's a dead-end street here, so any cars that come down here have to also leave the same way. And so I'm in the middle of the block here, and this camera is actually watches the whole distance from my house straight down to the corner. And I leave it like that. It goes into a time-lapse videotape machine. And, in fact, had an incident a couple of years ago where there was a little bit of a problem, and police were involved. And I gave them the tape of the, they were able to tell me, what they were looking for. We backed up, we saw the car that was involved with the people that did the deed, and we were able to get a good picture of it. In fact, it said with a little enhancing, you can most likely even bring up the license plate number. So, we saw them come down the block and saw them leave when they, after they perpetrated, or whatever you call it, the deed. Anyhow, like I say, we used to dump tons of that stuff because, we're always constantly updating. And it's interesting. I remember the view I was looking at from there, up there, where it's up about 40 feet, the camera. I was watching that time on 9/11 in New York. I zoomed in and was able to see, the haze smoke and what was coming up, in the hours and days that followed that that tragedy in the city. Let me think. What else? In general, also, I look at the, I look at the universe. I can look up at the stars and things like that, zoom in. And, in fact, the lunar eclipse was took place in the middle of the winter, cold weather, I sat in the comfort of the warm Radio Shack and watched the lunar eclipse on the on my own monitor. As far as emails, let's see. First email I have here, unless you want to make any comments before I start, Dick.
No, let's roll with some emails, Mel.
First of all, we got one from last week. If you remember, we helped out a young fellow, Tim, with his problem of trying to apply the formulas correctly. And he says, we got it now. We have no problems now. I see what you mean. It was never explained to us this way. Thank you very much, you and Dick. And in fact, he says he signed it. Thank you, 10 to the 6th power. I think we caused a little too much confusion last week. Because I got a couple of comments. They said, first you guys talked about your towers that stretch up into the stratosphere. A little bit understanding of that, how high they really go. And next thing you're telling us that these small or shortened loop antennas and a number of other compromise antennas you guys were talking about can work just as well. What should I do? Do I put up my tower? Do I order a tower, or do I take a hanger and just bend it up and stick it on the wall of my shack? I mean, where do I go? Where between these two points do I really go? I mean, why do you, why don't you tell us what the really the scuttlebutt is amongst you professionals, over?
Actually, you have to do both, as I see it now. I'm pretty sure you're going to give a similar answer. When it comes to VHF, which for the most part does not use the ionosphere, a signal on 2 meters and 220 and 440 megacycles, and even on 6 meters, much of the time the ionosphere is not going to help you. So it's line of sight, like communication. Yeah, there's some air mass bending, and occasionally a sporadic e-cloud comes along, but when the ionosphere is not helping you, and which is true of VHF and above, VHF, UHF and above, altitude is everything. Altitude counts a lot more than the quality of the antenna. A coat hanger antenna hung on a high tower is going to give you a lot more performance than a gold-plated billion-dollar thing in the backyard 10 feet off the ground. But when you're using the ionosphere on 80 through 10 meters, and particularly when you're in this right portion of the sun cycle where the band you're on is giving you good ionospheric reflection, you're considerably below the maximum usable frequency, which on 80 meters I think is true essentially all the time. I think 80 and 40, I'm not a big operator there, so I could be wrong here, but I think 80 and 40 are essentially always open. The band is open, meaning you're getting some pretty long range communication if you got the right kind of an antenna with the right polarization at the right time. At high noon at 80 meters, the D layer is going to give you a lot of absorption. And to talk more than one town away is difficult. But at nighttime at 80 meters, I think the band is always open. 40 probably has a similar characteristic. But at the low part of the sunspot cycle where we are right now, the real DX band, 20 meters, is probably not open very often. During the high part of the sunspot cycle, it's probably very rarely closed. When you're on 80 meters, and the ionosphere is the primary mode of communication, anything more than one town away, shall we say, anything beyond near ground range signals, then the infinitesimal dipole at a less than ideal altitude can give you the infinitesimal sized antenna at a less than desirable altitude can give you extremely good performance because the antenna is adaptable. You can adapt it in polarization, you can adapt it in azimuth aiming, you can adapt it in elevation aiming. That adaptability is something that's extremely important. I mean, just like on VHF, the price of the antenna and the performance of the antenna is not quite as important as altitude. On 80 meters, the adaptability is more important than the gain and the altitude of the antenna. I'm not saying gain doesn't help. I'm not saying altitude doesn't help. But the taller pole in the tent, the thing that's going to give you the most performance is adaptability. Because that signal that reflects off the ionosphere on 80 meters, I'm amazed that all the books don't cover this. And Mel has discovered it now over and over again. That signal that reflects off the ionosphere. Today, that guy has launched it. A vertical signal, vertical polarization, and you get it as horizontal. Tomorrow, he launches a vertical signal, and you get it as a vertical. The angle at which it comes at you from the ionosphere in elevation changes a little bit from day to day. But polarization is the biggie. So where you can aim the antenna in azimuth and elevation, but particularly twisted in polarization, that adaptable antenna in the shack, some significant percent of the time, and maybe it's 90% of the time, is going to give you more performance than the full-blown, full-size, 40-foot-high, full-wave loop, which is not adaptable. Yeah, there's a couple of rich guys out in California who have put winches on each of the four towers on the full wave loop, which has got a quarter wave on the side, and with those winches they can raise and lower those sides. I'm not quite sure what they can do with polarization. Maybe they can decide to feed it on the north side or the south side of the loop by flipping relays. But adaptability gives you a lot more performance than sheer gain in size and altitude. That's my understanding. You've been there. You've done it, Mel. And I bet you that's what I think you're confirming. K2KEY. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, yes, I've always said that, you know, put them up as high, big and high as you can. And, but I have, like I say, this antenna that I've been working with, you know, this indoor loop for the last year, approximately around a year, has been surprising me, and I'm afraid to really tell people the time that I did a test about a week ago, and Dick, the outcome was is mind-boggling. I'm starting to think maybe I did something wrong with my outdoor loop. I'm not looking into something correct on it. It exceeded. The outdoor indoor loop exceeded the outdoor loop, and it exceeded in a funny way too, because I was talking to, and I finally decided I gotta try with a transmission on this thing when we get it one night with decent conditions. And very seldom you're gonna find that now. Just happened one quiet night we had, and when I had this loop actually directed at a station that wasn't my regular friend in Pennsylvania, with somebody else, that he was on vacation. So I had a little bit of a talk with this gentleman, and I told him, I said, well, I'm going to go down to low power, so you're going to have to, you know, understand I'm not going to run a kilowatt plus into a loop sitting right next to me. But I'm copying you well enough and all. And he says, well, your signal is quite strong coming in here. So I said to him, well, let me try it down at about around 100 watt level, what happened? And he says, I'm still copying you real well. I said, now I'm going to switch antennas. And I switched over antennas after, of course, the antenna of the loop was peaked on him. He says, I think you got a little bit of a stronger signal. I says, oh my God. I went back to the loop, the regular outdoor loop, and I went back and forth, and he says, yeah. He says, I think just seem to have a little edge with your antenna B, which didn't tell him as indoor loop. Now, at the same time, there was a station I was talking also to another friend in Waltham, Mass. And he says, Tony, he says to me, now I lost you completely when you switched to antenna B. I do not get any copy at all on you. And I happened to slip with a lipstick, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, the antenna wasn't facing you, that's why. I know why I said that. I shouldn't have said that. And I said, just a moment. And says, when you come back to me, let me peek it up on you, antenna B, and we'll try it with you. And he says, oh, definitely. He says, boy, that really, really is amazing. He says, now you're going to tell me you rotated an 80 meter antenna at me? He says, now what have you been doing? What is this? He right away, his ears perked up. This guy's got a rotating 80-meter antenna. Well, you can imagine the stir it caused, Dick. So, I'm at a, really at a, you know, a point now with a dilemma. What exactly is taking place here, Dick? Over.
Again, it's the adaptability. And you've only done